from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Russia in Ukraine, ISIS, Syria, and U.S. strategy, Burger King to Canada. Ukrainians cry full-scale Russian invasion and appeal for help. Here's the Prime Minister.
Ukrainian forces are capable to tackle and to cope with the Russian-led guerrillas. But this is quite difficult for us to fight with Russia and its army.
President Obama says no U.S. military to Ukraine and no strategy yet on ISIS.
I don't want to put the cart before the horse. We don't have a strategy yet.
And Burger King to buy Canada's Tim Hortons donut chain and move to Canada. Here's a man on the street in Atlanta, not too happy.
It's a really big issue in our country when American companies are moving overseas just to pay less taxes.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg News, David Sanger of the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? Ukraine, Russia, Syria, ISIS, Uzis, and nine-year-olds? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington, Margaret Tolliff, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
From his refuge in Vermont, catching the last of the summer while he watches the world, David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. David, great to have you.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and David.
Let's go first to Ukraine. Maybe 1,000 Russian troops there, Americans say. Maybe 4,000 Ukrainians say. Here's CNN reporter Diana Magne standing in Mariupol, Ukraine, yesterday, listening to the fighting going on just miles away.
You can hear the crump of artillery fire in the distance. This is the main highway from Mariupol up to Donetsk, which is about 15K in that direction. As you can see, it is absolutely deserted.
With the artillery coming down. At the White House yesterday, President Obama said it's all about Russia.
Russia is responsible for the violence in eastern Ukraine. The violence is encouraged by Russia. The separatists are trained by Russia. They are armed by Russia. They are funded by Russia. Russia has deliberately and repeatedly violated the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. And the new images of Russian forces inside Ukraine make that plain for the world to see.
U.S. military action here, he was asked. No, said the president.
We are not taking military action to solve the Ukrainian problem. What we're doing is to mobilize the international community to apply pressure on Russia. I think it is very important to recognize that a military solution to this problem is not going to be forthcoming.
Margaret Tolliff, there's a lot to look at in the president's comments yesterday on Ukraine and the Middle East, ISIS, Syria, and more. But does the White House think at this point, Margaret, after all the sanctions that have already been laid on Russia, that the West is going to put the brakes on Russia's intervention, Ukrainians say invasion?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. He talked about incursion, not invasion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the timing of all of this comes as he is preparing to leave for this NATO summit next week in Wales. And the first stop on his trip is going to be this visit to Estonia, where he's supposed to be reassuring Baltic countries. So on the one hand, you can look at his remarks and say, boy, he sounds kind of feckless. I mean, if it's that big a deal, why isn't there going to be a military solution? And on the other hand, I think the signal that he may have been trying to send was to signal to the NATO allies and to the Western allies, hey, guys, I'm not doing this alone. And, you know, we need to band together and maybe tighten up the pressure on the economic front. You can't expect the U.S. to take care of this on our own.
David Sanger, I mean, the idea of Russia and the United States fighting, having troops facing each other, has been a big no-no for a very long time. Maybe nobody expected it here. But what did you read in the president's comments yesterday about where he expects this particular conflict to go? He's saying NATO, that's the red line, touch NATO and everybody's in. What about Ukraine, David? What seems on the board here?
Well, I think the big message here was that Ukraine's not a NATO member. And so by going to Estonia, the president is making it clear that he draws the line at NATO membership. And you'll remember that the key organizing concept of NATO is that an attack on one is an attack on all.
Yep.
The president has said previously that if they did go into a NATO member, the U.S. would have to respond militarily. But because Ukraine is different, it falls into a different category. I think the second thing you heard was his caution, because Russia is still a nuclear power, and you don't want to get into something that can escalate where you don't understand how it ends. And here, I think the president doesn't have a clear sense of where Putin's going to end this.
Russia pushing back, saying, look, stay out of our face here. There was an emergency UN Security Council meeting yesterday, and Russia's UN ambassador, the venerable Vitaly Churkin, not denying the presence of Russian fighters in Ukraine, but accusing America of meddling, interpreted here by Euronews.
I would suggest that we send a message to Washington. Stop interfering in the internal affairs of sovereign states, he says. Stop trying to undermine a regime that you don't like. Restrain your geopolitical ambitions. Then not only Russia's neighbors, but a lot of other countries around the world will breathe a sigh of relief.
Jack Beattie, how far do Russian forces go? They took Crimea with Russian Ukrainians there. Now they are apparently in Ukraine. They're talking about setting up a land corridor, but you know, where's the boundary? Is there one anymore, Jack?
There doesn't appear to be. You know, the threat of Western sanctions haven't deterred Putin from invading. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian offensive against the separatists in the east, that apparently has provoked him to invade. Western diplomacy, you could say, is a sort of things haven't been aligned. Their offensive and the sanctions just seem to be going in different directions. You know, one theory about what he wants this week is to divert Ukrainian forces from Luhansk and Donetsk, where they're closing in on the separatists, to the south. The other, as you say, Tom, is to open a land corridor. Some people say 100 kilometers by 600 long, connecting southern Russia to the Crimea and acting as a kind of land bridge there. That thought gained a little credibility this morning in an interview NPR did with a Moscow commentator, who said that he thought that was in fact the master motive of Putin, namely to shore up Crimea against any Ukrainian effort to take it back.
But David Sanger, there are a lot of potential of real Russian interests in Ukraine. Is there some end to this? Or might Moscow just stay with this sort of destabilization and military punches, feints, dodges, befuddlement of the world until they've got the whole thing back?
Well, Tom, you're raising the question here of what is Putin's strategy? And, of course, that's hard to figure out, especially at a time that he's trying to figure out what our strategy is and where our red lines are. But one of the theories that makes some sense to me is that if you go back to Putin's statement a decade ago that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century, which is a big statement when you think about the century, it's very possible that he is just trying to peel off the Russian-speaking sympathetic corners of other neighboring nations, so that he can expand Russia's borders through those areas that are occupied by Russian speakers. Crimea was the easiest. This is the next hardest. And what worries the White House the most is that there are Russian-speaking corners of both Estonia, a NATO member, and Latvia, which could well be next. And so one of the concerns here is, where do you draw the line so that he doesn't keep going?
Margaret, does the White House feel that it has strong European backing here? Winter's coming. They get their natural gas from Russia. They're already hurting economically. They don't want sanctions that bite into their own economies. I mean, if I'm Latvia or Estonia or Poland, for that matter, has been very vociferous. Where's their comfort that Vladimir Putin will, you know, at some point say, OK, enough, I don't want to face more pain?
Right. I mean, the president is not entirely confident about that the other Western allies will be behind him. Merkel's mood and motivation matters, always has a lot. But, you know, France is a mess. There are economic concerns there. The UK's got its own broader political issues outside of this fight. And David's exactly right that the line that the U.S. has drawn so far is around NATO allies. But the problem is that there are a lot of countries in the region that aren't in NATO. But even so, the U.S. really does not want to see Vladimir Putin reassert some sort of a creep back to, you know, a return to the Cold War or to the Soviet era. So it is really kind of a dare on both sides to see us how far he wants to go and for him to test how far the U.S. is willing to go.
But a very Obama moment yesterday with the sort of world running around with its hair on fire about Ukraine and Syria and Iraq and ISIS and the president, Margaret, with his message of steady here, restraint, calm, let's slow down, let's not get too far over our skis, he's almost saying.
In the tan suit, no less. We were all joking that he was distracted by his own tan suit. He was very calm and even to, you know, reasserting both in these two corners of the world that the U.S. is not going to jump into action just because it's under pressure to do so.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Russia in Ukraine. President Obama goes slow on Ukraine, Syria. Burger King goes to Canada, the Uzi, and the nine-year-old. David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, is with us. Margaret Tolev, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Jack Beatty's here. Margaret, we heard this week that President Obama had given a green light to American surveillance over Syria to look for potential ISIS targets after the beheading of James Foley and lots of ground gained by ISIS in the last couple of months here. Then he comes out yesterday in his briefing at the White House and says, oh, hold on, you know, people expecting bombing to follow on that surveillance, not so fast. Here was the president.
What I've seen in some of the news reports suggests that folks are getting a little further ahead of where we're at than we currently are. And I think that's not just my assessment, but the assessment of our military as well. We need to make sure that we've got clear plans, that we're developing them.
We're developing them. No strategy yet. Where's the Pentagon? Where's the White House? What are we waiting on here, Margaret?
Wow. And would you believe it? They actually really have been meeting quietly, not just internally, but with think tank experts and military experts for weeks now, with the understanding internally that ISIS is a really big problem that extends obviously beyond Iraq, beyond Syria. And you see now Britain raising its internal national terror threat. This is a major concern.
From substantial to severe just today, saying no specific threat, but related to developments in Iraq and Syria.
So there are a lot of discussions, and you could almost see when the president said we have no strategy, you could almost see that he had heard the words leave his lips and thought, oh, God, that's going to come out so not how I meant it. I mean, I think what he was saying was we don't have a strategy on strikes in Syria. And this has been something they've really been struggling with because since they decided to try to take on the Assad regime, it has really been a question of would the U.S. strike Syria? And that was always focused on Assad before. And now there's this sort of opposite, you know, seesaw balance of how to focus it against ISIS. You heard him say yesterday that basically he doesn't think the U.S. has to decide, you know, between helping Assad or helping ISIS, that there's still this middle ground. But boy, it's such a murky, you know, trying to find the quote unquote moderates who have any ability to stand up and govern in Syria. And so this is really what they're struggling with, is that President Obama's guiding philosophy on all of these sort of the idea of preemptive moves has always been, if you do it, you can't make it worse than it is now, that's the real danger of opening up a Pandora's box. And that's what he's fighting against. But the problem is that you see this started out as a Syria problem. Now it's an Iraq problem. Now it's potentially an international problem, that if you just treat it country by country and border by border, you run the risk of missing the bigger picture.
You could see the president not wanting to be rushed here. He said no strategy, but then he did seem to lay out a broader strategy, get a good government in Baghdad, get a coalition within the region and from beyond. Here he was talking what it's going to take on the ISIS or ISIL front.
Rooting out a cancer like ISIL will not be quick or easy, but I'm confident that we can and we will, working closely with our allies and our partners. For our part, I've directed Secretary Hagel and our Joint Chiefs of Staff to prepare a range of options.
David Sanger, no strategy yet. What does that mean? What does that suggest?
Well, there's a good interpretation of this and a bad interpretation of this. The good interpretation is that if you think back to the Bush administration time period prior to the surge and during the worst days in 06, and I was a White House correspondent. I had the job that Margaret's got now.
Yeah.
Very frequently, you would hear some action described as a strategy, and you would discover there was no strategy behind it. It was all tactics. So I found it somewhat refreshing to have a president come out and say, look, we don't have a strategy yet. And I did not read that as meaning that they won't have one. So that's the good interpretation. The other side of this is just what Margaret got at before. The Syria problem is not new to them. They've obviously been grappling with this and trying to come up with a strategy to deal with Assad for 3 years. You heard Hillary Clinton, among others, join the critics this summer that said that we blew our chances to go deal with Assad right 3 years ago. And the reason that the president moved so slowly was that in his definition of the Obama doctrine, which is that you only commit significant American military force when you've got a direct national interest at stake, Syria didn't look like that. Iraq didn't look like that. But ISIL running across those borders and having the possibility of projecting power out in terror attacks in Europe through these fighters who have passports, that may well look like a direct national threat to the U.S. and its allies. So that what you're seeing happen is that the definition of U.S. interests is changing before our eyes.
Jack Beatty, many people express some kind of cognitive dissonance. I felt it myself with Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel describing ISIS as this kind of uber threat, this really got its act together group and a big, big threat to the world, to the United States. President Obama, I think, called it something like the Junior Al-Qaeda's Junior League.
He said it was the
Junior
JV.
Varsity.
The
yeah.
Junior Varsity. It doesn't look so JV right now. And the president, you got the Secretary of Defense saying, big, big threat. The president talking about a limited response. How do those two things go together, Jack?
I don't see them going together. I took Hegel's comments to refer really to laying down a predicate for a strike. We have to have some reason for doing this. We can't get it through, a UN through the Security Council. Russia would veto it, even though they're against ISIS. Therefore, we have to find a rationale. Self-defense is the one available, and that's the one the president has cited in Iraq. And it took an extension of self-defense into Syria, and the way you do that is build up the threat that ISIS poses. As David said, this looks like a threat to American interests. So I think we're going to, you know, what it really reminds you of, though, is the kind of threat inflation that we heard from the Bush administration in the lead up to the Iraq war. You know, I mean, you went from, yes, Saddam could be a threat, to mushroom clouds and, you know, and all of that to build up this case. And I think my guess is the president was a little off message yesterday, or maybe he felt uncomfortable with this, insistence on the danger. But in any case, that didn't stop his UN ambassador, Samantha Power, just, you know, made it sound like this was the end of they're just a tremendous threat to U.S. interests. So I think they're putting down the rationale here.
Jack, maybe I'm buying the smoke, but ISIS looks pretty imposing to me. They've taken a lot of territory. Now, they've been pushed back off the Mosul Dam and elsewhere, but it doesn't look like nothing here. It looks like something pretty significant. I mean, and it's just one man, but it is one man. James Foley has lost his head. There's danger of another. This was the mother of Stephen Sotloff that ISIS said would be the next to be beheaded, potentially suggested as much, begging for mercy from the caliph, al-Baghdadi.
I've learned that Islam teaches that no individual should be held responsible for the sins of others. Stephen has no control over the actions of the U.S. government. He's an innocent journalist. I've always learned that you, the caliph, can grant amnesty. I ask you to please release my child.
Jack, we're in a new world here, a mother begging the caliph for amnesty, mercy for her child. But ISIS doesn't look like some toothless tiger to most of the world, I'd say, Jack.
No, although it was refreshing, at least in the American discourse, to hear an expert on Morning Edition today saying, well, you know, the fact that they're using Americans and foreign forces as their fighters right on the ground in Iraq and not seemingly reserving them, at least at this point, to attack our homeland, that's an example that maybe their main preoccupation now is solidifying their grip on that region. You know, the big risk here is being perceived as being Assad's air force. I mean, really. And a European diplomat voiced the consequences of that in an interview. He said that would feed the idea that Sunnis are in battle, that a crusader Christian Shiite alliance is persecuting them, and that all Sunnis must resist this alien invasion. That is the, you know, the real Charybdis, really, of this strategy. If the Silla is, of not becoming the Shiite air force in Iraq, this is the other rock to be avoided.
Oh boy, well, between the Silla and Charybdis, we're in trouble, Margaret. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say that's the foreign policy, implication or consequence. But I think, you know, domestically, since 9/11, the sort of other shoe to drop that everyone's always been afraid of is the problem of sort of homegrown terrorism or this resonating back home. And now we're starting to read reports about, in middle America and places like Minnesota, Somali women being recruited to go be the ISIL brides and this sort of thing. And this is kind of where the rubber meets the road. And, you know, over the weekend, last weekend, I was at this 200th anniversary sort of tongue-in-cheek celebration of the British burning of the White House. It was put on by some of the British embassy folks. And that was supposed to be kind of a fun, festive event, but there was a real pall over the area because internally the Brits and the Americans are very worried about the intelligence they're getting about the scope of ISIL and its potential roots and ties in Britain, particularly, and in the U.S. as well. I think that there is the foreign policy element of this and what goes on overseas, but there is also a real concern in the U.S. and in Western allies about the ties of ISIL to people back home.
Looks Paul-worthy to me, but what provokes and what puts down? Hassan in Seattle is calling. Hi, Hassan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom and guests. I'm actually going to change my comment a little bit from what I told your screener.
Sure.
And kind of touch base on what Jack Beatty said about not being perceived as the alliance of Shiites and Christians arming up against the Sunnis. However, I think, the Sunnis are being given a big pass on this. I mean, when you look at majority of the terrorist groups around the world, be it Taliban, Boko Haram, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, they're all Sunni groups. One way or the other, they get funding from Sunni countries, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and there's no pressure being put on these countries. The most powerful country in that region is Iran. We made some, headway as far as, perhaps working on them on certain things. Wouldn't working with Iran against ISIL and working with Kurds be the most powerful alliance there? I mean, there's nothing the Europeans can really do that the Iranians can't.
But that's even a bigger provocation to the Sunnis. But I take your point. They've got a very kind of checkered record here. David Sanger, if we need allies, if Obama wants to put together a coalition, what are the strongest parties at hand?
Well, certainly Iran is one of the strongest parties at hand because they are Shia who are deeply invested in the outcome here and detest ISIS more than the Iraqi government does and more probably than the U.S. government
does. But will the Saudis ever stop funding all this if it's the Iranians?
Well, the Saudis also are quite concerned about the rise of this level of extremism because the ISIS theology would suggest that the Saudi government is nowhere near what ISIS would view as needed for a truly pure Saudi government.
But the caliph is not satisfied.
Go back to the Iran question that Hassan raised here. The difficulty here is, of course, the president's number one objective in the Middle East is solving the Iranian nuclear problem. The other day, the Iranian foreign minister came out and said, we may be able to talk about helping with ISIS, but the first thing you'd have to do is lift all the sanctions against Iran.
Right. Sure.
Well, those sanctions are there for the nuclear program, and of course we're facing a November 24th extended deadline already for resolving that. If the president lifted the sanctions, which Washington has no interest in doing right now, that would end any chance of having a successful negotiation. So this is one of those cases where, as Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations says, in the Middle East, the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend.
I don't know if Iran's nukes stay number one. If ISIS keeps rolling, they've got allies in Pakistan now, Taliban there, Pakistan, of course, with its own nukes. David in Stanton, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have, just have two comments on this ISIS situation. I think we should go after them with all the drones and air power we possibly can. If it means having an alliance with Iran or Assad, then so be it. We have to do that. And it's like Churchill said during the Second World War when Hitler invaded Russia. If Hitler invaded hell, he'd try to have something nice to say about the devil and the House of Commons. And we need to, maybe we can strengthen our relationships and by forming a relationship with these people face this common enemy that we have to deal with right now.
David, I've got to, forgive me, but our time is short before the break, and if I may, let me just pick that one up. You know, make allies where you find them, David, to confront this. Let's say Washington, I don't know, did that or just took our caller's advice, air power, drone power, hit them hard, hit them from the sky, all over. Does that stop ISIS, David? Is that effective here? Do they have enough of a hittable target to really knock them down?
You know, I think that you can certainly keep them from advancing in some areas, and you saw that around the Mosul Dam where they did have some fixed locations. But ISIL is, at this point, amending their own strategy, taking on more of a guerrilla approach, going into more of the villages, and doing what al-Qaeda did very successfully in the days when we thought they were 10 feet high, which was work their way into the villages where it's much harder to go bomb you. The other thing, though, we have to remember from the al-Qaeda experience is that these extremist groups can wear out their welcome pretty quickly. As soon as they're into these villages and they're telling people who they can marry and who they can't, they're taking away many of the women in the region, they're killing those who they consider to be insufficient Muslims,
mm-hmm.
Then at that moment, they can work up a lot of local resentment. And, of course, that's exactly what happened in al-Qaeda's case, and it's one of the reasons that you were able to see an uprising against al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Jack, you can just – I, in the briefing yesterday, just felt Barack Obama looking for another way, not reaching for the gun in the holster, looking maybe for this to burn itself out. Maybe it's all kinds of things, but let's not get right back in that we take the hammer to hit the nail mode.
Yes, and he said that, you know, if you have this defense budget, that's the temptation. You're just going to – everything is going to be military. And I think he sees just how complicated this is. You know, to David's point, this week the Syrian foreign minister said that Assad was open to cooperation with us. He even said that if we had been cooperating with them, James Foley might have been saved.
Well, sure, yeah, but boy, all kinds of vectors here. Assad, no sweetheart. Margaret Tallev with Bloomberg News. Please stand by there in Washington. David Sanger at the New York Times. Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, American wine country Napa rattled by a big earthquake on Sunday. Lots of spilled wine. John Rule at Trefethen Family Vineyards bemoaned the damage.
It was heartbreaking. It was really, really a sad moment. And at the time, I think we're still in shock. It just did not feel real.
Chicago's all-African-American Little League team from Jackie Robinson West came home to big celebrations 31 years since an all-black team made it to the league's World Series. They lost 8-4 to South Korea, but walked away national champions.
Your United States Little League champions, JRW, come on out for the coaches and the mascots.
And a big night at the MTV Video Music Awards, Beyoncé stole the show with a huge emotional performance.
So baby, kiss me before they turn the lights out. Ooh, baby, love me lights out. Hit the top of tonight.
We're looking at a week in the news. You can join us. One, Burger King, are you still eating Whoppers? Will all our American companies go foreign? What was a 9-year-old doing with an Uzi in Arizona? Last words from Michael Brown, and what will last from Ferguson, and what are you doing for the long weekend? End of summer already with Margaret Tolove of Bloomberg News, White House correspondent for Bloomberg. David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times is here, and our own Jack Beattie. Burger King going to Canada, bought Tim Hortons, the big donut coffee chain in Canada, multi-billion dollar deal. Here's the chairman of Burger King, Alex Baring, saying that merging with Tim Hortons, moving to Canada, is not about paying U.S. taxes,
This is not a tax-driven deal. This transaction is fundamentally about growth, and the focus is on creating value through accelerated international expansion for both brands.
Well, White House wasn't happy with the whole thing, though. Not talking specifically here, but generally, Josh Earnest, press secretary, said Monday, it's not fair that American companies can avoid paying corporate taxes by moving their headquarters overseas.
The president, again, speaking as a general matter, not as it relates to any specific transaction that's being contemplated, doesn't believe that a company simply switching their citizenship, filling out a few papers to switch their citizenship to avoid paying their fair share in U.S. taxes, is good policy. It certainly isn't fair, and it certainly isn't fair to the millions of middle-class families in this country that don't have that option.
Burger King says that's not what we're doing, but Cindy in Council Bluff, Iowa. Cindy, you're on the air.
I don't believe Burger King's statement. I have lots of small business clients who are corporate. Mm-hmm. They are the only ones who pay the scheduled tax rates. Lots of the U.S. corporations want all the benefits of the United States. They don't want to pay their fair share. So fine, if they want our lower tax rates, I'm good with that, as long as we get rid of the loopholes and the preferences that let them pay 2% instead of 35%.
Cindy, not happy with Burger King, Cindy?
No, I will never walk in a Burger King again or go through their drive-thru. I've liked Whoppers better than McDonald's and Wendy's for years. Not anymore.
Not anymore. Cindy, I appreciate your call. Margaret Tolove, I can't figure out what's to stop American corporations from taking their headquarters overseas for lower taxes or you name it, other than consumer resistance. If consumers aren't a problem and your accountant is saying, well, you can save X 0.2%, whatever, by going abroad, what's going to stop them?
Right. I mean, Congress is not poised to stop them, and that's President Obama's problem. He has called this practice unpatriotic. He said that these companies are corporate deserters. This is the way you talk when you can't re-regulate something, and so you're trying to use sort of the bully puppet for public pressure. And it will be very interesting to see whether a lot of consumers stop eating Burger King. I'm an In-N-Out devotee myself, but you know, I that's neither here nor there. But you know, in this case, Burger King pays right now about 27.5%. That's their effective tax rate, and the tax rate in Canada is 26.5%. So I know these are wonky Bloomberg numbers, but there's some evidence to sort of support their case that this was about marketing and growth and branding and not predominantly about the inversion. The real problem for President Obama is that because in this case, Warren Buffett, who we all know as the second richest American, we all know as an important defender of President Obama's policies, the guy behind the Buffett rule, the one that said that the wealthiest Americans should pay at least 30% tax rate, that Warren Buffett is financing this Burger King deal to buy Tim Hortons. And but through that financing is sort of giving his tacit endorsement, you know, to what Burger King is doing. And that's a real bookend to the case we saw earlier this summer when Walgreens kind of backed out of it, was exploring doing inversion and backed away from it. And what the White House was hoping was that other companies would sort of follow suit and say, well, it's not worth the sort of bad press and the condemnation and the uncertainty of dealing with Congress. And the fact that Burger King is not only going to go ahead and do this, but is going to have the backing of a guy like Warren Buffett, who's really been for tax fairness and saying wealthier people should pay a fair share suggests that this may be more difficult for President Obama than he hoped.
Jack, to see Warren Buffett in on this deal was kind of bewildering. Now, he's helping finance it. You know, I mean, these get complicated. I mean, Hortons was already owned by Wendy's once. Burger King, biggest owner is a Brazilian private equity firm. But still, and yet, to see them go abroad with Warren Buffett anywhere near it, he may say this isn't about tax inversion, tax dodging. But, man, there have been a lot of companies doing it, and more to come, we're told.
Yes, Tom. Go ahead, David.
I was simply going to say there's an element to the American discussion here where we want it both ways. On the one hand, we want to have our biggest companies, Google and Microsoft and all, be treated around the world as international firms that are not just American firms, that shouldn't be blocked from going into China, shouldn't be blocked in Russia, because they're large international firms and not just American. And yet when they move their headquarters, maybe for the worst of possible reasons, maybe for tax evasion purposes, or at least tax, what they would call tax reduction purposes, we then say they've got to act patriotically. And
What is the problem with an American firm being an international firm? You don't see Chinese international firms being headquartered in San Francisco or Germany. You don't see Mercedes-Benz being headquartered in Algeria. They're all international firms. I don't see a contradiction there.
The only contradiction is the way one ends up moving one's headquarters really has relatively little to do with your presence in the United States. So
your full share of taxes, or maybe we need to reform our tax policy to keep them here.
Absolutely, and Congress has got to go do that. But to some degree, you really want to focus on where the job creation is. And so where they're headquartered, I find less interesting than where it is that the most innovative, high-paying jobs are located. And that's where I think you want to focus U.S. policy. And if you do that by having them have their headquarters in the U.S., that's great. But to some degree, I'm more concerned with where their jobs and their high-paid jobs are.
I don't know. I could see everybody's headquarters ending up in the Cayman Islands, nobody paying the full tax load here, except those like small corporations like Cindy was talking about and ordinary folks like you and me.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, and Tom, you put your finger on it. The difference between this inversion and the score of so others that have gone on recently, most of those were pharmaceuticals, you know, companies whose products, as the Financial Times said, means the difference between life and death, or can mean it. American consumers have lots of choices than Burger King. This is open to a boycott, to a kind of public pressure, in a way that these other companies haven't. And, you know, boycotts played a really formative role in the American Revolution. And it's a well-established American tactic to simply say, we don't like the politics of your economic plans, and we're going to protest by, going to McDonald's.
I mean, I wish Congress would get its act together and reform our tax policy so this wasn't such an issue. But after all, Americans are the ones who clog their arteries buying Burger King burgers to make this company, and now just blithely goes to Canada. Anthony in Montgomery, Alabama. Anthony, you're on the air.
Yes. How you doing?
We're okay, I guess. how are you doing, Anthony? Do you have a cheeseburger there, a Whopper?
I do, actually. No, not a Whopper, but a McDonald's Big Mac.
Yeah.
Okay.
Point being, I've eaten Burger King all my life. You know, I love Burger King, but I won't eat there again.
Somebody's got to stay on the home team here, Anthony. David's right. American firms have to be international. Margaret's right. It may help them. But a little consumer pressure may be the only little bit of leverage we have left to keep people on the home court, and I appreciate your call. Don't choke on that burger. Sad story out of Arizona. 9-year-old girl out at Bullets and Burgers, a shooting range in White Hills, Arizona, shooting practice with an Uzi submachine gun. Family visiting from New Jersey. Gun got away from her. The instructor there ended up dead. Here's the owner of Bullets and Burgers, Sam Scarmardo, talking with Las Vegas news station KTNV, saying, well, we instruct very young kids as young as 5.
A 9-year-old gets an Uzi in her hand when they're within the criteria is 8 years old to shoot firearms. We instruct kids as young as 5 and 22 rifles, and they don't get to handle high firearms, but they're under the supervision of their parents and of our professional range master.
Now, okay, Margaret Tullif, I was out in the woodlot as a pretty young kid with a 22 with my dad, but an Uzi at 9 years old, people just shaking their head.
Yeah, I've got a 10-year-old. She's allowed to use a water gun. It's almost like sort of beyond my capacity to talk about. I think this is, not a mainstream practice. But as we have seen since the array of tragedies that have sort of gone down from the Gabby Gifford shooting to Sandy Hook, there is no appetite in Congress to do anything about anything. And so until then, this just remains a political issue, an ideological issue, something up for debate, but not something where any kind of action is imminent.
Nothing imminent. American families, it's in their hands. But that poor girl, 9 years old, and how this will linger over her. And, of course, the instructor dead. Really sad. Political ripple this week. Mitt Romney, this was on the Hugh Hewitt show on Tuesday, former Republican presidential candidate, of course, saying he wouldn't run for president in 2016, but that circumstances can change.
Let's say all the guys that were running all came together and said, hey, we've decided we can't do it. You must do it. That's the one out of a million we're thinking about.
Jack Media, is that Romney head of hair back in the ring here, that hat?
Well, I think I saw a well-turned ankle there in that interview. He did say circumstances could change. Let's imagine what's going on inside Mitt's mind, the pros and cons. Pro, the polls show the voters are having, buyer's remorse over Obama by 10 points that Romney could think, I'd beat Obama if the election were held today. Pro, Iowa was my Waterloo in 2008. Mike Huckabee beat me there partly by pandering to anti-Mormon prejudice among evangelicals. But so it was hugely encouraging for me, Mitt, to see a poll this week that had me at 34% and at second, Huckabee at 9. Pro, finally, I need an intra-party rationale for running. I've got one to save the party from Rand Paul's isolationism. And he could go on with that. And another, and I may be the only candidate who can save the country from Hillary. The big con, you can imagine, the big negative, the economy. Fixing it would be my pitch, but what if it doesn't need fixing? Growth last quarter was north of 4%. If the Tea Party hadn't slowed the recovery by budget cuts and the like, the business cycle might be heading down into 2016. Mm. On the other hand, Clinton may be running in a boom, so maybe I won't run.
I don't know. Boom, maybe. David, can you imagine Mitt Romney stepping back into that ring?
It is hard to imagine, especially given what he said after the last election. But what it really speaks to, when you think that we're now nearly 2 years out from that election, is the paucity of other candidates that the Republicans have been able to generate a whole lot of enthusiasm about. Those poll numbers sort of speak volumes that no one other than Romney, the most familiar face there, could poll anything above 8 or 10%. And you would think that the party, having examined with care what went wrong for them 2 years ago, would be developing some group of alternative candidates so that they didn't have to run out what looks like a candidate who, ran last time and tried to run the time before that.
We'll see what happens there. Funeral this week for Michael Brown in St. Louis, near Ferguson, of course. His father Pastor Charles Ewing giving a eulogy at Michael Brown's funeral.
Am I my brother's keeper? This is a question we should ask one another. God's purpose for this to happen, even though we can't fully understand, but at such a time as this, God is shaking this nation.
Give a son to shake a nation, maybe. Joe in Marfa, Texas, our time is short. Joe, you're on the air.
Yeah, just one comment about Ferguson. I've worked many places in the world, and what amazes me everywhere is that there's always one group or race or tribe that thinks that they're better than the other tribe. But the only thing America has is that we are the only ones who keep trying to solve it. I mean, the Germans with the Turks, the English formerly with the Irish. Even in my country, or as born Poland, with the prejudice against Jews before World War II.
Yeah, the North Chinese with the Southern Chinese, and right. It's true. You can go on and on. There's a hopeful observation, Jack, on this country. Ferguson is tough. It lit up a lot of very tough things. We feel bad we haven't solved them, but Joe says, hey, we're still talking about it.
Yes, he's with Thomas Wolfe. We are lost in America, but I believe that someday we will be found. Wonderful sentiment. Unfortunately, the polls seem to point the other way. They point to a really stark difference between whites and African Americans on how they evaluated the police response in Ferguson. Maybe that'll narrow. And then there's the other problem, that the grand jury, from what I've been reading, is maybe very unlikely to indict Officer Warren. And this week, a Supreme Court scholar said the Supreme Court recent decision suggests that neither the officer nor the city are likely to be held accountable for this death.
Well, our thoughts with the family of Michael Brown this week as all that went away. Oh, geez. Spoonful of sugar behind his 50th anniversary of Mary Poppins. What a complicated tapestry of a country and culture we have. It's all out there. David Sanger, what's the weather report for your, I don't know, last summer weekend in Vermont, sir?
Well, it's looking beautiful here, and the good news is for Jack, his visa just came through. He can come over the New Hampshire border into Vermont.
Give it a try. David Sanger with the New York Times, Margaret Tala, Bloomberg News, Jack Beatty, thanks to all of you. And yeah, we could use a spoonful of sugar. Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.